This is April the 14th in the year 2001, and this is Bob Gilgore interviewing David Kirkman at the Chapel Hill Public Library. Good morning, David.
Good morning.
Thank you for coming here this morning and allowing me to interview you. I appreciate it.
It's my pleasure, and it's very, very interesting just to have all these old memories jogged and stimulated.
Let's start with you telling us about where you grew up and your schooling, and take us up to date.
Okay. My early years, 0 through 10, my family bounced around the South and the border states, as my father was a military officer, a medical intern, a medical resident, a medical postdoc, and then a medical professor. And we went from South Carolina to Tennessee to Maryland to Oklahoma, where I lived from about 1959 to 1965. And then in 1965, my father took a job at the medical school here, and at age 10, maybe 11, we moved to Chapel Hill. I attended Glenwood Elementary School for 1 year, sixth grade year, and went to the fairly new Guy B. Phillips Junior High School. Went to Chapel Hill High School and graduated in 1972. After that, I went down towards Charlotte and attended Davidson College, came back, attended law school at UNC. And that's pretty much it as far as my formal education, where I lived.
What did you do as a lawyer?
After law school, and even during law school, I worked for an organization called Legal Services for the Southern Piedmont. It's the Greater Charlotte Mecklenburg Area Legal Aid Agency, a federal anti-poverty agency designed to assist poor people through providing legal services, civil legal services. And for a few years, I did landlord-tenant cases and domestic violence cases, consumer fraud cases, a lot of more run-of-the-mill type legal services such as divorce, child adoptions, child guardianships, a few other miscellaneous cases. We also would sue the state or federal government from time to time over certain benefits that people were not receiving that they should have received. So I did that until the early 80s, and then it appeared that President Reagan was going to succeed in abolishing that organization because it was federally funded. It was controversial. I came up to UNC and took a job for a while. Most of the mid-80s, I worked on campus at UNC at the Student Legal Assistance Program. And then from 1987 through the present, I've worked in the Attorney General's Office in the state of North Carolina, and I handle cases involving fraud against the elderly. I work in the Consumer Protection Division, and we try to stop those who would scam old people. That's what I've done as a professional.
Sort of advocate for the poor and the underdog.
Most of the time, that's what I've done. Mm-hmm. And there was 1 year we lived in Nepal. My wife is an anthropologist. She had a Fulbright fellowship to do her PhD research. And we lived over there. And talk about underdog. That's an entire underdog nation. But I learned a lot of things over there that had parallels back to what I had seen here as a kid. What I saw here as a professional.
When you went to school in, was it Oklahoma before you came here? Did you go to an integrated school there?
Eventually, yes. It was an all-white elementary school called Longfellow Elementary School. And it was lily white until, I would say, fourth grade. And then there was a sudden influx of black students. The decision had been made to integrate the Oklahoma City schools. During fourth and fifth grade, we had an integrated elementary school.
So that was 63 to 65.
That's right.
Then you came here and went to Glenwood 65 to 66, Guy B. Phillips 66 to 69, and then Chapel Hill High 69 to 72. Do I have those dates right?
You do.
Can you tell me what your experience at Glenwood was like? Was it integrated when you went there?
It was not. It was one of the shocking things that struck me. I was struck by the difference in accents, the quality of the school was not that great either. I was surprised by that. Coming from Oklahoma City, one would think, you know, Chapel Hill High or Chapel Hill would have much nicer schools. But at that time, I was just sort of struck by this older school, and everybody was white. A lot of differences. But it was almost like going back in time.
So the physical structure of the school was not the quality that you had experienced before, is that what you're saying?
That's right.
What about the education that you got there? Was it that quality the same as what you had experienced before?
It's interesting. As I came into Chapel Hill, the school system, there must have been some kind of assumption that because I was from Oklahoma, I was stupid, or I had not been learning at the level that the Chapel Hill kids had been learning, and so it wasn't correct, but nevertheless, I was put into some of the lower tiers. They had tiered learning back then, and I was put into the lower tiers of math and English. Everything else, we all studied as one class, but when it came time to learn English or math, we'd go into these separate classes. And so I was thrown into these lower tier classes and started noticing the caste system that existed in Chapel Hill at that time. And I hearkened back to it when I lived in Nepal, which is a Hindu country, and the whole stratification. But it was not until I was in seventh or eighth grade in the Chapel Hill school system that I was learning math at the level I had learned in Oklahoma City. And in, you know, this supposedly more backward system, more, you know, there was sort of an arrogance there, which I don't think has much to do with today's discussion. But anyway, that was one of the things that shocked me, but the bigger shock was it was just lily white. And the only child of color there was Angela Lee, Howard Lee's daughter. She was in my class, Mrs. Gordon's sixth grade elementary school class.
How do you remember her as the only black student in that class?
Well, there just were no other black students. I remember I've gone to all the way through high school with her and even overlapped a year or two in law school at UNC. But just as I first came in, noticed all these white faces, almost totally white, and then there along the side of the classroom was Angela. And she was probably like me, somebody new to the school, probably going through some of the same things.
Was she treated any differently from the other students in your eyes?
Well, there was, you know, the ever-present cliques and factions and groups of friends, and probably it took her a while to work her way into some of those, just as it took me a while. But I don't think she was treated badly at all.
No name calling
or no,
jostling in the hall?
Nothing like that. I don't think there was anything like that. There was very little of that even in Guy B. Phillips Junior High in the following 3 years. There were a few incidents there, but I think to their credit, the kids in Chapel Hill at that time, most of them were pretty decent to one another on racial issues.
You mentioned a caste system of sorts. Could you spell that out a little more?
Well, in the educational system, there were probably four or five different levels at which these different subjects were taught. And the stratification sort of paralleled the social stratification in the school. Some of the more cool crowd, at least at that time, were in the top levels of, you know, Mrs., I forget her name. There's one teacher who, Mrs. McAllister, taught, you know, the kids in sixth grade at the highest levels of English and math, and they were sort of an elitism there. They were, you know, basically nice kids, but the elitism would come out from time to time, and the cliques and clannishness on the playground, I guess, in other venues, you know, it was always, they were the cool crowd, they were the ones everybody wanted to emulate, wanted to be. And if you were in probably the lowest level, everybody just sort of looked down upon And he's, you know, just totally within a group comprised of white students. There was still that arrogance and maybe some resentment going the other way. And that tiered system was used throughout most of my tenure in the Chapleton school system. It dissolved away probably as I was in 11th and 12th grade.
So are you saying that the wealthy students were also cool students, and they were also the ones who were in academically advanced courses?
Mm-hmm. There were exceptions, obviously. The core of the sort of the highest stratum there was, on the male side, was a guy named John Barry, who was not from an academic family, but from a very wealthy family. And the others around them happened to be, you know, professors' kids for the most part. And on the female side, I didn't notice it as much on the female side. I just remember, you know, which girl was good looking, which girl was too smart for me to hang around. That's what but the stratification, it was pretty obvious from an early state during my tenure in Chapel. Trying to remember Angela Lee in that class. I know she did very well academically and socially. I don't know if she had the same qualms about what she was seeing. This is the sort of thing you would see in any school, actually. There's always an in-crowd, an out-crowd, an outcast crowd. As I went through school, you know, that dynamic changed. The more rebellious kids became the cool kids. Some of the people in the earlier, higher stratum were considered nerds by the time we got to the end of the road.
Are there any other memories you have of Glenwood that you want to share in your year there?
Not really. It was a nice place to go to school. It was, you could tell everybody there had some kind of connection to the university, directly or indirectly, either as son or daughter of a staffer or a faculty member or a merchant or service person who served the university and the university community. It really was a university town back then. It was such a small town that Estes Drive, the part in front of what's now this library, was paved. But as you crossed Franklin Street, went over towards the bypass, it was a gravel road. This was the outer boundary of Chapleton. And it was a small place back then.
Did you feel that the teachers were role models for you, mentors? They were your advocate?
At the time, I seldom thought that at Glenwood, but in hindsight, I think they really were. Mrs. Gordon, I recall, started to push and elevate me up through this stratification fairly quickly. And she seemed to encourage me, even though I was sort of a slacker as an academician back then. My interests were elsewhere. I was more into basketball, sports, Boy Scouts, all kinds of other things. Staring at Laura Krebs, the beautiful daughter of Juanita Krebs, Cliff Krebs.
Well, let's move on to your experience at junior high school, Gumby Phillips Junior High.
Yes.
What are your memories of Phillips?
A lot of new faces. I mean, that school was comprised of people who had come out of Carver Elementary, Estes Hills Elementary, and Glenwood. And so there were a lot of new faces, and there were a lot of black faces. It became more like what I was used to from Oklahoma City. It seemed something that suited me more personally, and I actually thrived in it more because most everybody was a newcomer there. I mean, there were still these little groups and cliques to which I did not belong, at least up to that point. But it was a fresh start for everybody, and there were all these students of different backgrounds, colors, and we were just thrown into this mix, the junior high school lifestyle. Going from class to class, seeing each other in the hall and at the lockers, it was a much more dynamic existence there. And racially, as I mentioned, it was more of a school of color. The racial harmony there, even at the time, I was very impressed with it. There was still this segregation within the stratification of classes. White kids still attended individual classes, mainly with other white kids, with some exceptions. But on events like sports, school dances, even the lunchroom, there was a lot of interaction from the very beginning. And I recall that in seventh grade, we had this fabulous ninth grade basketball team with a lot of excellent athletes, black and white. And we were very proud of that. And usually the other schools that would come in and play us were just these lily white schools from places like Northern Durham or Southern Durham or Cary. And we were all quite proud of that. The atmosphere in the hallway or in the parking lot or during lunch when we were all playing basketball together, there just wasn't much racial animosity, at least not on the surface. And during my tenure there, I remember Angela Lee being elected either as ninth grade class president or student body president. There was a lot of interracial dating, at least during eighth and ninth grade, if I recall that. There was some grousing about it here and there, but it nevertheless was happening, and people were fascinated by that phenomenon they hadn't been seen.
Was it interracial dating in one particular form, or was it black female, white male, black male, white female, sort of that kind of equality?
It was almost totally black male, white female. Usually black male athlete, white female, but not always. I cannot recall a black female dating a white male. It might have happened. At that time, across the nation, there was a time of a lot of tension. The history is full of what was going on in 66 and 67. Yet in popular culture, it was a fantastic time to be a junior high school kid. Rock and roll music was really starting to open up and evolve. Rhythm and blues and soul and Stax Records and Motown, everybody was fascinated by that. The music was just superb if you were a kid. And the movies were starting to feature black actors, even casts that were mainly white. Things were changing and students were excited by it. Some of them, depending on their persuasion, saw it as a threat, but I think for the most part, people thought it was cool. They thought the music was cool. They thought the athletic teams were cool. Charlie Scott showed up at UNC during that period of time, and people were just wildly enamored of him.
White and black.
White and black. And I remember just going to see Charlie Scott, watching him practice, greeting the team as they would get off the bus from a big game. It would be Charlie Scott, everybody shaking his hand. It was a fantastic time. I mean, a lot of things were opening up, maybe not fast enough, maybe not in the right way, but in the hearts of a lot of these white kids, things were opening up. Opportunities were opening up for the black kids, I think. Their older brothers and sisters were not able to experience a lot of what we were able to experience at that time. There's a lot of downside to it as well.
What was the downside?
A lot of it happened in, sort of came to the surface when we were in high school.
Let's stay with the junior high.
Sure.
And then we'll get on to that. I wanted to hear more of your experiences at Phillips.
Well, just as in sixth grade, and my interests were in girls and playing sports and Boy Scouts. It was the same in eighth and ninth grade in junior high. And I was on the Phillips eighth and ninth grade basketball team. I don't know why. But I was on those two teams. And it was like the one I described a minute ago. It was very integrated, predominantly black, eighth grade, ninth grade team. The the stars of the team, almost all the starters were black. We would travel to places like Roxborough or over to Raleigh, Hillsboro, and play teams that were still lily white, pretty redneck, and catch the cat calls as we got off the bus from time to time. But we were very proud of it. We had this super camaraderie, traveling to and from these games. A lot of singing and chanting, a lot of dirty jokes, a lot of Doug Clark and the Hot Nuts songs were sung and recited. Just a lot of back and forth, giving each other a lot of shit in a jovial way, because that's the way jobs are.
Was there support for the black athletes, black students, when would go someplace where it was all white and you would hear these cat calls? How was that handled?
The cat calls were usually not in the gym, not where you would have somebody in authority to make people shut up. It was usually lingering afterwards outside the gym, between the gym and the bus, and there'd be some rednecky kids from Carrington Junior High shout some kind of shit. I remember one of them getting the crap beat out of him. I can't remember who was involved in that. One of these white kids said something, and the next thing you know, he's up against the wall, just getting pummeled, and that ended that. But there was not much of a need to intervene on the part of our coaches or our administrators that I recall. Occasionally, in ninth grade, we would go over to places like Shepherd Junior High, where I was, not Shepherd, maybe it was Shepherd. It was the junior high that was affiliated with Hillside High School. It was the black junior high.
Was it Whitted?
Whitted. It was Whitted.
Yeah.
We would go to Whitted, and John Birch and Bob Dylan and I would be about the only white people in that whole facility. But we were treated fine. People would make fun of how bad we played. Beyond that, there was not much direct insult thrown our way. And, we could see how it felt from the perspective of our black colleagues on the team. It was an eye-opener.
How did you feel?
A little bit afraid. I was also trying to, interact with people over there. And there was a little bit of wariness, I think, on the part of some of the people I would come and try to chat up. I remember sitting in the bleachers during the junior varsity game. The eighth grade was called the junior varsity. We talked to some of the players from the other team, some of their fans. It was not a totally relaxed conversation. I think they just kind of looked up, what's this white kid doing, talking to me and chatting me up. So I'm sure there were parallels the other way around. But it was extremely enlightening to go through all that.
You had mentioned that while there was a merger of black and white schools at the junior high school, there was this tracking where many of the classes were were almost all white.
That's right.
Are you saying that within each individual classroom, there really was not an integration?
I'm absolutely saying that. They were basically white classes and black classes side by side. But the individual classes, depending on the subject, it's usually it was English or math. It was usually an all-white class or an all-black class.
And
sometimes in the mid-tiers there would be true integration.
And how did they rate those classes? Were the white classes the higher academic levels and the mixed classes the intermediate and the black classes the lower? Is that fair to say? Or
they tended to fall along those lines. By ninth grade I'd made it into the highest stratum of the caste system for English studies. And that class was totally white. The class I had in English in eighth grade was actually a fairly integrated class. I remember three or four lot of kids in that class, probably like 22 kids in the whole class. My eighth grade class, I remember Donnie Tuck was in there. He was one of the most gifted students academically and athletically. He was in that class in eighth grade. There was a young woman named Audrey Johnson. You know, I kind of had the hots for her. I thought she was rather attractive, but I didn't have the courage to ask her out or anybody else out in eighth grade.
A black girl.
Yeah, she was only there for about one semester. She moved into town, and then she was gone at the end of the semester. But my point is, in that more mid-range English class, it was like upper mid-range, there were still kids who weren't white. Whereas by the following year, when I supposedly made it to the top, and I still don't know how I made it into that class, but I was in that class, and we were just as white as that piece of paper. So very prominent kids, and academically, they must have ended up in the good schools. Sons and daughters of professors and wealthy merchants. But it was just white as could be.
Did you see any difference in how the African-American students were treated by the teachers?
And the classes, individual classes like civics, PE, or some of the others, science, I didn't see much differentiation. I didn't see much of it at all. I never saw a teacher do anything overtly racist or say anything overtly racist about a black kid or disparage a black student. I'm sure there were slights delivered that I couldn't perceive at that time. I'm sure that there were. But I think most of those teachers were fairly progressive and really valued having those kids in their class. I thought it was important. And to the extent that I remember any of my teachers in 8th or 9th grade ragging on students, it was usually the spoiled, smart-ass white kids who were trying to disrupt your class. I hope your microphone can pick this up because I had my knee in front of it the whole time.
Yeah, it'll pick up all of that.
Was there any reference at any time to a black history in the classes you were taking, or to the individual history of the community history, where the African American students came from, what school they came from, the traditions of their school?
In junior high, I think the history class I remember was 7th grade North Carolina history. There was almost no reference to black history other than the slavery issue. It wasn't until 10th grade history class that we really sunk our teeth into those issues. The history teacher we had there, Mrs. Clayton, taught from John Hope Franklin's book, From Slavery to Freedom. But in junior high, I don't recall anything of that sort. The English classes that I had in 8th and 9th grade, the teachers would incorporate black writers into the curriculum. And from that, you would obviously get a taste of some of these history issues. But I don't know that it was affirmatively taught other than that.
Did you have black teachers at that time?
I did. I know I had Mr. Pierman for PE in health class. I had Mrs. Harry in 9th grade, I'm sorry, in 7th grade as a music teacher.
About your core curriculum classes, English, math, science, courses like that, history, social studies.
No, I don't think I had a black teacher for any of those classes.
Did they have any black teachers for any of those classes?
Yes, they did. They had there was a black science teacher in 7th grade, as I recall. I could hear him because we had one of these double classrooms with a partition in the middle, and I always had my head leaning against that partition. I could hear him. I think his name was Mr. Samuel.
Goldston? Was it Mr. Goldston?
Let me refer to this junior high school publication, annual. I may have him in there. Mr. Goldston, I recall, was there as well. Let's see, this is in ninth grade. Mr. Goldston, science. Yeah, he was there.
And there's Mr. Foreman, science, but he was, I guess, white.
He was white.
So there's a mixture there, but...
There's Mr. Samuel. He might have been South Asian. He was certainly a gentleman of color. Mrs. Barnes, I never had her, but she was well-known and well-regarded. Mrs. King taught social studies, and I think she was in class next to mine, but I never had her.
Betty King.
Mostly they were white teachers. Tell me, a junior high assistant principal, my ninth grade year, was Benny Renwick. Hayden Benny Renwick. He was also my ninth grade basketball coach. And his career seemed to take off rather quickly. He was, when I was in eighth grade, he was a PE coach and junior varsity basketball coach. Next year, he was assistant principal. The following year, he was an assistant dean at UNC or something like that. So he was, in a way, a role model for a lot of people, just the way he skyrocketed. He was a colorful fellow, very tightly strung. He was a good coach, wouldn't take any crap off of any official or anybody, you know, especially in an opposing venue. I remember one time he jumped in some guy's face. He was the starter. He was getting mad at me because on this old cinder track at Cary Junior High School or Cary High School, I was digging little divots to, you know, stick my cleats in as I took off. And this guy was jumping all over me about it. He's jumping all over him. So you're talking about teachers who would go to bat for you. We had plenty there, and he was one. He could jump in your shit also. But we had a lot of teachers who, at that time, seemed to really care about the students. They seemed to care about integrating things and not inflaming things, at least not overtly. I think they, in the end, inflamed a lot of things in an unconscious manner.
How so?
Through slights, through the maintaining the stratification, maybe some of the unspoken feelings that they might have had towards kids who came out of the segregated black schools in this community.
How did you perceive the black students you came into contact with?
Well, I think the most contact I had with them in starting out was in band class. There were a lot of kids of color in band class, and I perceived them just to be my buddies and my friends. The occasional black face that you would see in English class, like there was a fellow named Christopher Smith in my seventh grade English class, and in other classes, I remember thinking, he must be really smart. They've got him in here with all these white kids. And that was just my view of it. He must be smart because, you know, down the hall would be a class full of black kids. And everybody, whether they said it out loud or just thought it, probably believed, well, they're in there because they're not as smart as we are. That was the message we were still receiving.
So the flip side of that, one student who you felt must have been really smart was that the mass of the black students who had come there weren't really smart.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that was a pervasive? Well, that's not a fair question because you can't get into the minds.
No, I can't. I feel sort of ashamed taking that view because when I arrived in Chapel Hill, I was the victim of that same sort of stratification. There was a lot of assumption that I wasn't that smart because of where I came from. And yet here I was a year later taking the same damn attitude. But I remember thinking, well, Christopher Smith must be really smart. Donnie Tuck must be really smart. Angela Lee must be really smart. She's in this class with all these white kids. And So I did have that reaction, at least. I'm sure I was not alone. But in other classes, the PE classes, the music classes, band class, those were fairly integrated. They were not stratified, and people got along extremely well. A lot of joking around, a lot of interaction. Not as much as you can interact as a seventh grader. Kids then didn't really have parties very much or go out and socialize too much.
Did you ever have any other students sleep over your house, or did you sleep over other students' homes?
No, I don't remember that very much. Sleepovers. I was very involved in Boy Scouts back then. And I guess you'd call that a big sleepover. I mean, we would go on a camping trip once a month.
Was that integrated?
No. It was, I think all the troops back then were white that I knew of. There might have been a black Boy Scout troop. I just didn't know of one. There was a young fellow who joined our troop, and he was from the Piney Mountain Road community, one of the many black sub-communities in Chapel Hill. He came down to our scout meetings and joined our troop for about a year, but he didn't stay around very long.
Are there any teachers or events that stood out in your mind when you were at the junior high school at Phillips?
The two who stand out the most were Bill Pierman, the PE teacher and coach that I had. Also, there was Zora Rashkus, and the two of them stand out for totally different reasons. I guess I'll start out with Bill Pierman. And this is something that bothers me to this day, the fact that Bill Pierman, when I arrived, he was the coach of the 8th grade basketball team, and he was a PE coach as well, a PE instructor, coaching this little 8th grade basketball team. This was in 66, 67. The coaches of the 9th grade team, which was the varsity at Guy Phillips Junior High, were two fellows named Katz and Janowitz. From up north, two young guys. Katz had played on the UNC basketball team, either varsity or junior varsity. Perhaps had a valid reason for being the coach. But as time wore on, as I went through junior high and high school, I started learning more about Coach Pierman and the fact that he had been a magnificent coach at Lincoln High School, had several championships at Lincoln High School in various sports. And yet when I got to Guy V. Phillips, he was the 8th grade basketball coach behind two young white guys, the head coach at the old Chapel Hill High, Bob Colton, was the head coach of the basketball team out there. He was the head coach of the football team out there. And maybe he was a very able administrator. The little I saw of him as a coach, he seemed to be an okay coach. But damn it, he didn't have all those championships behind him. He didn't have that kind of history. And I was blessed to have Pierman as my coach in track, basketball, and football at Guy V. Phillips Junior High, and he was also a coach when I was there in high school at Chapel Hill High. But for reasons I'll tell you later on, I kind of got out of high school athletics, but most of my interaction with him was in junior high, 8th grade through 10th grade. And he, by the time I was in 9th grade, actually when I was in 8th grade, he was the coach of the 9th grade team. And again, it was this magnificent team. It was integrated. People were extremely proud of it. He was a fantastic coach and did well by them. I had Benny Renwick as coach of the 8th grade team. In 8th grade, Renwick and Pierman both coached the track team. It was our very first track team at Guy V. Phillips. We were great. We just kicked butt. We had a wonderful team. It too was fairly integrated. We had people like Bernard Watson. He would just won every race he entered. see, Earl Bynum was a really good sprinter. He had some so-called distance runners, like I was a distance runner. 440 was my race, and that was considered a long distance race back then, and I was pretty damn good. And we had a killer 440 or mile relay team. It was me and Bernard Watson and some others, and nobody could beat us. And Renwick and Pierman put that team together, and it was fantastic. And again, we would go off to these little schools in surrounding counties, and everybody was white, and we were just proud of it. And we had this integrated track team, and we kicked butt. And it was the same the following year. When I was on the ninth grade basketball team, Coach Pierman was the coach of that. We had a fantastic basketball team. People were proud of that team. Track team was pretty good, but nobody ever goes to track meets, even to this day, unless they're in Europe. But Pierman, during those years, he seldom let it out that he had bitterness about the way he was being treated, even at that moment. He would talk about, you know, these fantastic championships. He would talk about these characters who played on his team, cut-ups and jokesters and colorful players. He would talk about people like Thurman Crouch, who was a fantastic football player. Thurman Couch, I think he played at Iowa or Iowa State. He had stories about players like those, and he would regale us with them. And he'd do it as we were, you know, suiting up to go out and practice on the football field. He would talk about them on the bus trip to a game over at Cary or Hillsboro. He would often incorporate them into these motivational speeches at halftime. He was a tremendous motivator. He actually formed our ninth grade football team. He put it together. I'm sure he had to get the okay and some funding from the school system.
You mean they had no football team before then?
No, the junior high had no football team at all. And so I remember at the outset of our ninth grade year, this notice goes up on the wall that, you know, there's going to be a football team and tryouts. And in fact, word of it got out even before school started. There was going to be a football team. Everybody get in shape. Start doing your conditioning. And so we did. And we had a big tryout. And he selected a team. It wasn't that great a team in the end. But again, it was the same sort of team. It was a team of color. And it was criticized for having too many players of color. But the fact of the matter was, the really good athletes, the really good football players, were not the lily white professor kids. They were the kids from the black community. And so I've got a picture here that shows those of us who were on that team. And it really was predominantly a black team, even though the black student body was fairly small. And I remember then the catcalls and the comments, you know, in the hallway. Often by the parents when you're out in the community about, he's got this black football team. And there was some bitterness over that. And he at one time alluded to that during the beginning or aftermath of practice, talked about when people were complaining about how I put this team together, and you know, we're going to show them, you know, I put together the best team I can, we're going to represent Cuddy Phillips, we're Falcons, we're going to do, you know, all this wonderful stuff, we're going to show the world. And that was, you know, his style. He would also put on that team some people from the black community who seemed to be at risk. And I remember a couple of guys who nobody would think they'd be decent football players. But Pierman put them on there and also put one of them on our basketball team because he was concerned about him and what was going to happen to this fellow. And unfortunately, it didn't work, although his pride was just welling and he was very happy with himself. And in the end, he kind of spiraled, you know, down in life. And I would see him in the court system years and years later. But Pierman, to his credit, was trying to reach out and help that kid by putting him on that football team, by putting him on the basketball team 3 or 4 months later. Football team did okay. I think we won 3 and lost 2. One of the most interesting vignettes I can share with you was we didn't have a blocking sled. All football teams, especially the linemen, need a blocking sled to start practicing your blocking and learn how to block hard and block straight ahead and, you know, not block too high, not block too low. we didn't have a blocking sled. And so Coach Pierman called on one of his buddies, the shop teacher, who'd been the shop teacher at Lincoln. I think he was now out at the high school. And the shop teacher came out one day with a pile of lumber, and we hauled the lumber down the hill onto the practice field at Gabby Phillips. And this fellow...
Was that R.D. Smith?
It was R.D. Smith. He and a helper or two started sawing and bolting this thing together from these 2x4s and 2x6s. And all of a sudden, as we practiced, we could see this blocking sled take shape. And it didn't have all the springs and the metal sled devices underneath it, but it was taking shape as a blocking sled. And then as practice wore on, R.D. Smith would strap on these old cushions, blocking cushions. You could tell they were like World War II vintage. They were just so old, and they were made of canvas. And at the end of practice, Coach Pierman, after, he would practice you hard. He would run you to death, and it was hard. I remember he was so excited about that blocking sled, he made us go over there and start blocking on it. And he and R.D. Smith and some others were standing on the sled, which is what coaches do, shouting and barking at us to push harder and push harder. But I remember it just sort of this getting by on a shoestring almost to construct the equipment that this football team needed to function. And they did it. And the fact that R.D. Smith could just put that thing together so quickly was amazing. But that was another vignette.